From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This morning, the Supreme Court heard arguments for another case challenging the right to abortion. FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine challenges the use of mifepristone. That's a medication typically used in a two-combination dose to terminate a pregnancy. Medication abortions account for roughly two-thirds of all abortions in the country, and this ruling can affect all states, regardless of what protections are in place. But there is more also at stake than abortion. This case could impact the FDA's regulatory power to approve all drugs and evaluate their safety. Leslie Gilo-Jacobs is an Anthony Kennedy Professor of Law at McGeorge School of Law and joins us with a breakdown of today's oral arguments. Good afternoon, Professor Jacobs.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So on the surface, it can look like what is challenged is just one drug used during a medication abortion, but this case can cast a wide net of potential impacts. So let's just start from square one and we'll work from there. Why do the plaintiffs believe they have a case?
Well, the claim in their case is that the FDA didn't rely upon accurate evidence in expanding access to mifepristone in the past couple of years. And so they are questioning federal agency action and saying that the court should hold that it was not reasonable. In fact, that it was arbitrary and capricious.
Is there an argument that there has been harm in the years since these rules have been relaxed, you know, due to the pandemic?
Well, certainly the FDA would say no. And to break down the case, too, I just want to point out that I did listen to the oral argument this morning and I heard the justices doing the questioning. I heard both sides arguing. And there are three separate questions in the case. The middle question is the one you're talking about, which is whether the FDA has the authority to expand access to mifepristone in various sorts of ways, making it available through telemedicine, allowing nurse practitioners, for example, and not just doctors to prescribe it, and expanding the number of weeks of pregnancy from 7 to 10. Those are the questions in the middle here. And what we're dealing with, interestingly, of course, the courts interpreted the abortion right to be gone from the Constitution, and the claim there, or one of the reasons, was to return decisions about abortion to democracy. Well, this is democratic action. This is a federal agency operating under the authority of a federal statute and making a determination according to federal procedural rules about whether a drug is safe and how they can best provide access. And so that's what the middle challenge here is, that the challengers are mounting to the authority of the agency to make this decision. I should point out that before that, and this is, I said, I listened to the oral argument and I also looked at the case. There's actually a constitutional question that comes at the beginning, and I happen to think the decision will hinge upon it. And that is whether the particular people who are challenging this, that's an organization and six doctors who are part of it, who have religious and moral objections to abortion, whether they are allowed to come before court and to make this argument. And I think the answer is no, from my point of view as a legal scholar. And I saw a majority of the justices agreeing with that. So I think that the court's not even going to reach the question about what the FDA did. They are going to say that these people aren't allowed to bring their challenge because their injury isn't closely enough related to the FDA expanding access to mifepristone. That's technical legal, but that's where I think it's going to go.
Given that mifepristone was approved by the FDA more than two decades ago, I mean, back in 2000, and currently, as you mentioned, it can be used for up to 10 weeks of pregnancy, but obviously there has been some loosening of restrictions since 2016 up until the pandemic in 2021, where it allowed for telemedicine. You didn't have to go to the doctor. You could pick it up at a pharmacy. What do these plaintiffs want? Do they just want an outright ban of this medication, or do they want to scale back to the year 2000?
Oh, well, they would love an outright ban, and they certainly wanted to scale back to the year 2000, and they got that from the district judge in Amarillo, Texas. But then it went up on appeal, according to the procedures we have in our legal system, and then the appellate court said, no, you're not allowed to do that. It's too long. You can't just suddenly bring a challenge. It's been 2000. And so that's why we're focused on just the expansions of access to the drug.
Hmm. Unlike the Dobbs decision, you know, in 2022, which reversed Roe versus Wade, this could impact abortion care in all states, even California, which has some of the strongest protections. If there was a ruling in favor of the plaintiff, I mean, would that be immediate?
Well, it could be if the Supreme Court were to side with the plaintiffs. But what's at issue in this particular case would be that we would go back to a situation where the drug is available, but under further restrictions. That is, fewer weeks, doctors have to prescribe it, can't do telemedicine, fewer restrictions. Those would be the rules that the FDA would be imposing. So, yes, it could affect everyone everywhere. I want to emphasize, too, that this is about a particular drug, but the challenging of the FDA's authority applies to all drugs, and it applies to the FDA's authority generally. And it would apply to any sort of drug approvals, and particularly the questioning of the particular scientific evidence that the FDA relied upon. The plaintiffs are asking the court to make a judgment about that and to say that's not enough. And the argument of the government is we have expert agencies for the very reason of looking at particular studies and making a judgment about them. And those are the agencies and the entities that should be making decisions about the public health of all the people in the United States, not a few judges.
Yeah. So it would potentially open up judges, as you mentioned, looking at the efficacy, the safety of drugs when, you know, that isn't their scientific expertise. Their background is in science.
It's not their expertise. They decide questions of law, and they usually defer questions of fact, and they say those aren't things that we're particularly good at deciding, particularly when we have a democratic structure whereby Congress gives these decisions to agencies and staffs them with scientists and people who are supposed to be able to become expert in making these decisions and balancing, right? Access versus safety.
I also think it's interesting that when you go back to the Dobbs decision, I mean, that related to also to state sovereignty. You know, it allowed states to make the decision on the right to abortion. But this case is kind of doing the opposite. It's federally trying to limit access and the authority that states have to make that decision.
Well, yes, by attacking federal agency action and saying that the agency didn't have the authority to do what it was doing. And so, yes, I mean, it would limit access in the states, although it is looking at the federal agency action. States would still be able to do a lot of things that they're doing, but they couldn't contradict the federal agency.
Hmm. You know, given that, as you mentioned, you listened to the oral arguments this morning, you got a sense in their responses and questioning of how the justices are responding to this legal challenge. Was it surprising that did their responses and their questioning, did any of it stand out to you or surprise you?
It didn't surprise me. One thing that happened in this case is that the justices put on hold the court decisions that were limiting the agency's action. And so while that's not a slam dunk for sure what the result is going to be, it did show that the justices were skeptical of the lower court decisions and were willing to keep the FDA decision in place. Additionally, even looking at the arguments, they don't make sense. That is, according to the precedent that the Supreme Court has established, these people should not be able to bring the case before the Supreme Court. And additionally, as far as questioning the scientific judgment, it's not a strong case to do that. And so it's not surprising to me. As a matter of fact, it's encouraging to me to see the number of justices who were very skeptical about recognizing this claim. The one thing I will put on everybody's radar screen, which is something that was raised and was just briefly mentioned by Justices Thomas and Alito, who are the ones who seem like they would support the lower court ruling, is this ancient statute called the Comstock Act. And the Comstock Act was from the 1800s, and it said no obscene, lewd, or lascivious material can be sent through the mails. But then it particularly mentions abortion and anything. You can't mail things that help procure an abortion. Now, when Roe versus Wade was in place, and it's been decades and decades, nobody was enforcing it, the federal government wasn't enforcing it. But then Roe versus Wade and the abortion right, of course, the government's not going to enforce it because it would infringe upon that. But with the abortion right gone, that is going to be a tool that anti-abortion activists are going to try to use. They're going to point at this old statute and they're going to say, you haven't enforced it for decades and decades, but now you should, because now there's no right to abortion. And this was raised in this case because this has to do with mailing abortion drugs. I heard two justices talking about it. I don't think the justices are going to get to the question, but we will see it in future cases, and we certainly will see it if the administration changes and somebody else is controlling enforcement by the Justice Department of federal laws.
Okay, so you can see this case shaping other legal challenges in the future that could arise. I mean, you mentioned about being able to mail medications, but there are other cases. I mean, there's one from Idaho, which is challenging federal rules requiring abortion during a medical emergency. Also, Alabama's Supreme Court, they ruled in February that frozen embryos from IVF and vitro fertilization are considered unborn children. There's even some analysts believe that this could even extend to birth control potentially. So do you see a legal pathway now that this could impact other legal challenges? This isn't just, you know, a case in a vacuum. Do you see a legal pathway for potentially a nationwide abortion ban, whether it's successful or not, but the attempt at least being made?
Oh, yes, I could see the attempt being made. No question. Absolutely. And if the justices thought they were getting themselves out of the business of deciding abortion cases, I think we knew that wasn't true. And certainly what you're saying, it's absolutely, completely not true. All sorts of questions are arising, and the justices are going to have to decide them. I happen to think in this particular one, they're not going to accept the challenge. But this is the type of challenge that we'll see. And you mentioned it. It's to agency action and to the ability of states to have action. With the mailing, it's going to be mailing in. The Comstock Act has to do with mailing. These are all things that the courts are going to have to decide. It'll work its way up, and we'll see the Supreme Court deciding them too.
Given that you served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Associate Justice Lewis F. Powell Jr., you have a unique perspective on the inner workings of the Supreme Court. What stands out to you about why the court chose to hear this case?
Well, they chose to hear the case because the lower court had put restrictions in place. And so those would stay in place absent the court hearing it. And there actually was another court case that ruled differently, which would be another reason why we have a split. We call it a split in the decisions. And so what the court wants to do is to have uniform rules in place. And so that's an easy explanation for why the court would take this case, and as opposed to wanting to affirm it.
And that decision from the lower court was back in August. It was the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which ruled in favor of the plaintiff. They're based out in Louisiana. I'm just curious how this jurisdiction of a circuit court, which spans more than one state, how do jurisdictions of circuit courts, because I believe there's 13 in the country, how could that potentially shape how they rule?
Well, the composition of the court can make a difference. And certainly the Fifth Circuit is composed of justices who would be sympathetic to Republican pointed justice policy arguments. That's just what the composition is. And they've been, there are various decisions that have come out of the Fifth Circuit and have gone up to the Supreme Court. The majority of justices have not accepted all of them. But you also bring up the issue of judges and the judge shopping that goes on here, because certainly this was filed with the judge in Amarillo, Texas, because of his opposition to abortion and rulings prior to that. And so, just recently, the Judicial Council has issued new rules about assigning cases to try to avoid this sort of thing happening with litigants choosing judges who they think will be sympathetic to their arguments. Now, of course, that happens all the time, but this was a single judge district, and it was particularly obvious what was going on. And so there has been movement by the council to make changes there. But otherwise, often the litigants do get to choose where they go, because there are lots of places where this impact happens. And so there is choice in where you file a case.
Now that oral arguments, they were just this morning, what happens between now and when a ruling is expected?
What happens now is the judges will meet in conference on Friday and they'll vote. They'll vote in reverse order, and then they will understand who's in the majority and who's in the dissent. And then in the majority, it is the most senior justice in the majority who assigns the opinion. I'm going to predict, and the chief is the most senior, even though he hasn't been there in most years, I'm going to predict he'll be in the majority. And so he'll be able to assign the opinion in the case. He'll assign the opinion in the case. And so the that judge, justice, will write an opinion. And of course, the clerk will help, and then circulate it among all the chambers. And then the justices will decide to join, or they'll write their concurrences. And then the dissent will see what the opinion is. They'll write their dissent. And once we finally have all the back and forth, they'll send it to the clerk, and they'll put on an opinion and print it all up. And all the reporters will get to stand outside and get copies of it.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Since you've been a law clerk, what would you be doing to assist a justice during this time between now and Friday?
Writing, well, there would be four clerks, and if I were the one on the case, between now and Friday, not much. I would have already written a memo before the case about it, and there wouldn't be much to do between now and then, but the justice would come back. Justice Powell came back with his handwritten notes about who said what and what to do, and so if I was the one on the case, he'd give them to me and say, write the opinion.
And when could we expect a decision?
Well, they end their opinion, they end their decision making at the end of June. So we'll see if it takes that long. It could well at this point.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Finally, Professor Jacobs, you teach constitutional law, government law, women and the law. These all intersect with the case that we're talking about. How are you talking about abortion cases with students, really, since the 2022 Dobbs decision reversing Roe versus Wade?
Well, interestingly, we just covered that last week, the abortion case, and actually finished it up this morning. And I talked about this case in my constitutional law class this morning. And so I cover the abortion cases by showing both the doctrine, but also the history and the evolution of the cases and how justices explain their decision making. And I look at overrulings, because this Dobbs isn't the only overruling of cases. And I ask the students to think about what judges are supposed to do, which is something different than politicians. Politicians do what the majority wants and what their policy preferences are. Judges are supposed to be doing something different, interpreting an enduring meaning that someone else wrote and had meaning to. And I'm asking them to try to figure out, well, how do you make that sort of judgment? Is consistency important? What is the reasoning, and why do judges write their reasoning, and what should you look at to find it convincing? And so it's been very, very interesting to do that.
Professor Jacobs, thanks for stepping out of class. I know it's busy for you, and joining us with the breakdown.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Leslie Gilo Jacobs is an Anthony Kennedy Professor of Law at McGeorge School of Law, and joined us with a breakdown of today's Supreme Court oral argument centering on mifepristone, which is a medication that is commonly used during an abortion. And a note, McGeorge is a financial supporter of CAP Radio. Up next, California's salmon population has been in rough shape for decades, but a new plan aims to stop decades of decline and revive this iconic species. We'll learn more about the state's salmon strategy. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.